And Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, ladies and gents, this is your unctuously genial host, John Derbyshire, with news and views from the past week. All quiet here on the Aegean front, and I say that consciously because there is a slight but noticeable World War I theme in this week's broadcast. Not inappropriate, given the coming centenary, and brought to mind by Mrs. Derbyshire's latest report from the home estates in Long Island. All the snow has melted at last, she tells me, but only to reveal the lawns in such a dire state. Her description sounded like Flanders 1917, but without the trenches. Well, no doubt our loyal staff of gardeners will soon have matters in hand. Meanwhile, on with the show.
Let's go on with the show.
The Heritage Foundation blog ran a report March 31st titled Why the Hispanic Media Are Biased and What to Do About It. Heritage, you'll recall, is the foundation that fired Jason Richwine for passing on the true fact in his Harvard PhD dissertation that Hispanics have a lower mean IQ than non-Hispanic white Americans. The core of Heritage's policy line is to promote conservative principles while keeping the borders wide open to millions of incomers who will never in a million years vote for those principles. This Heritage blog piece concerns a study by the Media Research Center that came out this week dealing with Hispanic TV. 17% of the population is now Hispanic, one in six. And they don't want to watch no stinking gringo TV. They watch their own channels, like Telemundo and especially Univision, which reaches 97% of Hispanic households and actually beats the English language networks regularly in ratings. On TV watching, by the way, blacks are way out ahead at 7 hours a day average, whites next at 5 hours, Hispanics close behind at 4.5, and Asians last with 3 hours a day. The Media Research Center finds that commentary on Hispanic TV is way left. Sample quote, the top three US domestic policy topics covered by both newscasts were immigration law enforcement, immigration reform legislation in Congress, and Obamacare. The majority, 59%, of Univision and Telemundo's stories on these three issues tilted left liberal. End quote. What a surprise. Look, you don't need a study to tell you this. Hispanics come from Latin American countries. All those countries are state corporatist or outright left socialist. The parsimonious assumption is that they are that way because that's the way their populations have shaped them over the centuries. If those populations come here in great numbers, which they have, they'll shape us the same way. Peoples, the populations of nations, have group characteristics. Little towns in the North Midwest are run like little towns in Scandinavia, because the people in them are descended from Scandinavians. Black majority cities are run like African cities, with a big man dispensing favours and pocketing cash bribes. Orthodox Jewish communities centre around their synagogues and schools, because that's how Orthodox Jews do things. It's amazing that these things even need saying. Import 40 million Mexicans, you just Mexicanized your country to some degree. The Heritage nitwits are having none of that. What we Conservatives have to do, they tell us, is get converting all these Hispanics to Conservatism. They even, heaven help us, they even have their own heritage Spanish language blog, libertad.org. Here's a suggestion for the heritage people. Would it be too much to ask, before we import another 40 million Mexicans and Central Americans, would it be too much to ask that you demonstrate some actual success in actually persuading any large number of Hispanics actually to vote for conservative politicians? It would be too much to ask? Yeah, that's what I thought. I'm starting to feel guilty about never saying anything much about Obamacare. I know, it's important, I know, I should have an opinion. I just can't engage with the thing. The two root facts about healthcare in a civilized country are, one, that a lot of citizens won't be able to afford much healthcare, and two, that we're not going to let sick people go untreated. From those two facts, some kind of socialist solution follows by pure logic. If a sick person can't afford healthcare, and we're not going to let him suffer, then someone else is going to have to pay for him. That's socialism. Robbing Peter to pay Paul. Or in this case, Paul's family physician, radiologist, anaesthetologist, orthopaedist, ophthalmologist, urologist, gynecologist, cardiologist, otolaryngologist, and proctologist. I think we Americans are in denial about this. We hate the word socialism, and we think we hate the thing too, but of course we don't. Try shutting down welfare or social security. In healthcare, the opportunities for self-deceit are maximal. We can have this rickety structure of insurance that isn't really insurance, just pretend insurance, and those thousands of pages of regulations, and health exchanges where we can pretend to engage in market transactions with pretend insurers. It's all bogus. Obamacare just made it boguser. We flatter ourselves that we're exceptional because we don't have that horrid socialized medicine that other countries have. Well, we sure are exceptional. No other country has a lobby for a US-style healthcare system in its domestic politics. Most insane of all is the yoking of healthcare to employers. This has to be a huge drag on US businesses, impacting our competitiveness. It started accidentally in World War II, when companies weren't allowed to give pay raises, so they gave perks like health insurance instead. Yo, people, World War II ended 69 years ago. Not only are employer-based policies a millstone round employers' necks, they create rancorous and unnecessary social conflicts, like the ones over Obamacare's contraceptive mandate that the Supreme Court had arguments about last month. What a huge waste of time and resources, including judicial resources. In 2012, the healthcare dollar broke down this way. 28 cents came from private households, 26% from the federal government, 21% from private businesses, 18% from state and local governments. Put it another way, 44%, getting close to half, came from government at some level. And we hate socialism? Right. I say let's go single payer, with plenty of private options for those who can afford them, and a true system of insurance on actuarial principles for those who want something better than the socialized provision, which of course won't likely be more than adequate. Let's drop the fake exceptionalism. It's exceptional to stagger around all day with a 100-pound slab of concrete strapped to your back. It's also stupid. The IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has come out with a new report, the first one for 7 years, and it's a doozy. Quote, "No one will be untouched by climate change, with storm surges, flooding and heat waves among the key risks of global warming in the coming decades," claim scientists. End quote. At the same time, a contrarian group of scientists called the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change, the NIPCC, brought out a report of their own, taking issue with the IPCC report, whose main content has long been known in advance. Here's a sample of the different conclusions you get from the two reports. IPCC, quote, "Risk of severe harm for large urban populations due to inland flooding," end quote. NIPCC, quote, "No changes in precipitation patterns, snow, monsoons or river flows that might be considered harmful to human well-being or plants or wildlife have been observed that could be attributed to rising CO2 levels. What changes have been observed tend to be beneficial." End quote. Each of these reports is over 1,000 pages long, and I'm going to confess right now that I won't be reading them, though I may glance through the executive summaries. Here's the Radio Derb take on this issue once again. There's a science of global warming and a politics of global warming. The science says we're in a decades-long warming trend, and human activity contributes to it. Hardly anyone disagrees with that. Even climate change contrarians agree that, yep, we're warming, and yep, human activity is partly responsible. There are a lot of differences about the degree of warming and the mechanism involved, but on the outline facts, the science is, as they say, settled. And then there's the politics. The central idea here is that a major international effort is needed to stop the warming trend. The IPCC people lose me there. When I hear the words major international effort, the thing I hear right after is the sound of money sluicing from the pockets of middle-class taxpayers in prosperous countries, people like me, into the salaries of arrogant globalist bureaucrats and third-world corruption pits. That's what major international effort means. That's what it always means. If I'm arguing with an IPCC fan, at that point he says something like, "But what if there were an asteroid heading straight for Earth? Wouldn't you want international action if that was the only way to stop it?" My reply, I might, if you could convince me of that if. It wasn't international action that put men on the moon, was it? In any case, the two situations aren't comparable. Climate change is slow, even on the doomiest models. A capable nation can deal with whatever it brings us. Less capable nations might indeed have a hard time of it. But again, efforts to help them would end up in some dictator's Swiss bank account. It's up to the civilized world to keep civilization going. The rest must shift for themselves as best they can. The expression, swamping the lifeboat, comes to mind. As the NIPCC report reminds us, warming will have some upsides. I can't believe the downsides are beyond our ability to cope with. We're a tough little species. We've survived much worse things than a gradual warming trend. Whether we shall survive if civilized nations surrender their sovereignty to globalist bureaucrats is a different matter. Every so often I find myself thinking how radically strange Western liberals are. A lot of them are very intelligent. Hey, the faculties of our universities are stuffed with them. Yet, there are quite a lot of areas of knowledge they just can't engage with. Statistics, for example. Try telling a liberal that, on average, men are taller than women. There's a good chance he'll respond with something like, "Oh, so you hate women then?" This essay piece on Slate.com put me in that frame of mind. The title of the piece, "Teaching Tolerance: How White Parents Should Talk to Their Young Kids About Race." That's the title. The author is Melinda Wenner Moyer, not otherwise known to me. I have ventured into precisely this territory myself, so naturally I was interested to see what Ms. Moyer has to say. Quote, "Last summer my family moved from Brooklyn to a small town in the Hudson Valley. We love our new life, but one thing about the community is not so great. It's predominantly white." End quote. According to her byline, Ms. Moyer lives in Cold Spring, which is indeed in the Hudson Valley, a town of 2,000 people, 0.45% of whom are black. Let me see, 0.45% of 2,000? I make that 9 people. 1,991 white people, 9 black people. That's just barely enough blacks for a basketball team. A few minutes with my gazetteer showed me that Ms. Moyer could easily have found a much blacker community than that. Wappingers Falls is only 10 miles away, 7.5% black, and the original home of Tawana Brawley. What more recommendation could you have than that? Peekskill, 10 miles in the other direction, is 25.5% black, twice the national average. If you don't mind a longer commute, Ms. Moyer, and hey, these are quiet country roads, and it's a small price to pay for some vibrant, enriching diversity. 20 miles north of you, there's Poughkeepsie, which is 36% black, nearly 3 times the national average. Perhaps Ms. Moyer wasn't diligent enough in her house hunting. And what's not so great about the town being predominantly white? Not so great? The USA is predominantly white, ma'am. Is the USA not so great? No, please don't answer that. Ms. Moyer's main question is, what can she do to, quote, instill racial sensitivity and acceptance, end quote, in her kids when they're growing up among all this not-so-great whiteness? Keen to find an answer, Ms. Moyer read lots of books and, quote, talked to developmental and social psychologists, race relations researchers, and Africologists, end quote. She doesn't tell us whether she also talked to some Europologists, Asiologists, Americologists, Australiologists and Antarcticologists. Perhaps she did, I don't know. I was only 2 paragraphs into the piece at this point, but the will to live was draining out of me fast, and I gave up. In search of something, anything, to put Ms. Moyer's hypocritical ethno-masochism out of my mind, I idly started reading the headline teasers down the right-hand side of the Slate.com page. Headline: Some of America's toughest soldiers are from a black regiment no one has ever heard of. What? Do we still have segregated regiments? Oh, it's about World War I. Headline: The devastating, sneaky genius of John Roberts' opinions. Headline: Paul Ryan says, I don't have a racist bone in my body. Why does every famous person accused of racism say that? I guess I don't really count as famous, but I have been accused of racism. And I didn't say the thing that Slate.com says Paul Ryan said. Matter of fact, I do have a racist bone in my body. It's one of my dorsal vertebrae, the 11th actually. And it gives me hell when there are black people around. I have to carry ibuprofen if I'm going anywhere vibrant. Headline: If you're against gay marriage, you're a bad CEO. Headline: Even in preschool, black students are much more likely to be suspended than white students. Headline: Do LGBTQ students deserve a special graduation ceremony? Headline: How schools discourage some girls from pursuing STEM. That's STEM, science, technology, engineering and math. Headline: The disturbing reason why nearly twice as many whites as blacks support the death penalty. Oh, wait, I can guess this one. It's because white people like killing black people, right? Headline: Even in preschool, black students act up way more than white students. Headline: The single fact that explains why black Americans have such a hard time climbing the economic ladder. Those are the Slate.com headlines. I actually made one of them up. See if you can guess which one. This seems to have been everyone's favourite story of the week, and I have to admit I couldn't resist it either. I say that uneasily, though. 6 people are dead here, and no doubt their friends and families are grieving for them. So I guess this comes under the heading Schadenfreude, although I'm not feeling any Freude, which means joy, only a mild, wry, guilty amusement. So here's the story. A chap in South China died at age 75, which is a good age. No tragedy there. South Chinese people are generally conservative, and this guy's family did what traditionalist conservative Chinese people do in the circumstances. They went to the local cemetery to pick out a plot. If you're a traditionalist Chinese, that's no small matter. In fact, you need an expert to tell you which plot is the most auspicious, based on the surrounding scenery, gradient, rocks, plants, and so on. You need a feng shui man. Feng shui means wind and water. It's a body of traditional ideas, I refuse to say knowledge, about which places, heights, orientations, and so on are lucky. So this family, who must have a bit of money, hired the best feng shui man in South China, a chap named Zheng Guoqiang, surname first, of course. They brought him up from Hong Kong, over 100 miles away, and took him to the cemetery. Mr. Zheng did a diligent survey and at last announced he'd found just the right spot for the grave, a spot where all the forces of wind, water, earth and sky were in harmony. He gathered key family members in that spot and began explaining to them all its harmonious perfections. Before he could get very far, there was a sudden mudslide on the slope above him. 7 people were buried alive. 6 of them, including the feng shui master, died before they could be dug out. The death toll was given in the press as 2 of the relatives, 3 cemetery workers, Mr. Zhang, and, quote, a Taoist named Wu. A Taoist named Wu. Isn't that a Johnny Cash song? Further quote from the news story, quote, a friend of Mr. Zheng's, metaphysician Li Chengzi, told Tomo News, that's a Taiwanese newswire, he was puzzled as to why Mr. Zheng had decided to visit the cemetery, as that particular Sunday was a bad day to go there. End quote. Yeah, hindsight's 2020, pal. But what's with that metaphysician? I wonder what kind of credentials you need before you can call yourself a metaphysician. Is there a licensing board? Do you have to carry liability insurance? I could have sworn that mudslide was a purely mental phenomenon, but no, it was material. Sorry. As I said, no psychologically healthy person will get joy from this story. On the other hand, you can't help feeling, well, I can't, that sometimes the universe is trying to tell us something. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Headline of the week from the London news aggregator Metro. Quote, masturbating yogi throws dead animal at passing car. This happened in George Washington Memorial Park in the lovely Commonwealth of Virginia. 68-year-old Bill Catchley was holding a yoga pose among the trees there when 2 women walked by on a hiking trail. The sight of the women caused Mr. Catchley to emerge from his meditative state and enter a masturbative one, in full sight of the ladies. So he ceased holding his yoga pose and commenced holding his wife's best friend. And in fact, not just holding it, but, says the police report, stroking it with no attempt at concealment. The arresting officer further reported that, quote, the subject then picked up a dead animal, ran into the northbound lanes of travel on the George Washington Memorial Parkway, and threw the dead animal at a passing car. He then returned to the trail, pointed at both women, and masturbated again. End quote. We are not told what he pointed with, nor the species, genus, family, order, class or phylum of the thrown animal. A chicken would be my guess. The police have been interrogating Mr. Catchley for several hours, trying to get him to confess, but my information is that so far he's holding his own. Item. Still time to sign up for the running event of the year, the Pyongyang Marathon, to be held in the North Korean capital, April 13th, with runners from all over the world welcome. As it happens, I have a sound clip here from last year's event, the very beginning, when they fire the starting gun. Just kidding there. Mind you, if you do sign up for the Pyongyang Marathon, you need to be a really fast runner. You know, to keep ahead of the dogs. All right, insert your own North Korean jokes here. First prize, a week in Pyongyang. Second prize, 2 weeks in Pyongyang, etc., etc. Item, There was a curious little piece in last week's Economist about military medals. There's a whole philosophy behind medals, and it needs rethinking. The highest form of medals, the one we're usually thinking about, is the Medal for Acts of Great Courage, the Medal of Honour, the Silver Star, and the crosses given by the various service branches. Then there are medals for hardship and suffering, like the Purple Heart and the Combat Infantry Badge. Then there are medals for just being in a combat theatre, like the ones my dad brought home from World War I. And there are campaign medals for special wars and medals for achievement, even if outside a combat theatre, and so on. Well, it's all being looked at. Our Defence Secretary, Chuck Hagel, has launched a review of the medal system to start in June and last for a year. One motivation here is to find some way to honour the guys who sit at computers out in the Rockies guiding drones onto targets thousands of miles away. They do great work in seeing off the enemy, but at no risk to themselves. It's not a new thing to give medals to desk jockeys, but these have always been considered lower ranking than combat medals. The touchstone for ranking medals has been, and should be, in my opinion, courage and effectiveness under physical danger. As The Economist says, a single-minded focus on just results is troubling. Quote from them: "By that logic, more medals would go to snipers and assassins than to soldiers who saved comrades' lives." End quote. Well, good luck with that review panel, guys. There you have it, gentle listeners. Did you catch the World War I references there? They were a bit thin, I'll grant you, but enough to give me an excuse for some World War I music to see us out. Here's the great Irish tenor John McCormack, keeping the home fires burning. More from Radio Derb next week.
Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning. Though your lads are far away, they dream of home. There's a silver lining through the dark cloud shining. Turn the dark cloud inside out till the morning.